Well, good morning. It's Jeff Wine, host of The Car Show here on Sun Sounds Radio. Folks, once again, we have an action-packed show for you today. We're going to catch you up on the latest and greatest of the world of the automobile. I've got an interesting article regarding the Chinese auto market and what's going on with the United States and U.S. manufacturers over there. We'll also talk about what's going on with NASCAR and their lawsuits by two teams that have sued them for antitrust violations. We'll catch you up on a couple reviews and a couple classic cars, a Ford F-100 and a Studebaker. We'll also talk about a passing of a NASCAR great. And then we also will catch up with gas prices. And, of course, it wouldn't be The Car Show without a little car talk. You know what to do. Fasten those seatbelts nice and tight. It's going to be a fast ride on The Car Show. Well, from the pages of CNN, the headline reads, "The retreat from the world's largest automaker has begun." Well, it wasn't long ago that China was by far the largest and most profitable market for General Motors. While the company was hemorrhaging money in North America and Europe and hurtling toward bankruptcy and a bailout, sales and profits from China allowed it to keep the lights on. Now, the opposite is true. General Motors is making record profits at home, but it's losing enough money in China that there are questions about how much longer it can stay. At the same time, Chinese automakers have flooded their home market with exactly the sort of desirable electric vehicles that Chinese buyers want and American automakers once dismissed. And the result has been catastrophic for foreign automakers in China. Well, General Motors' Chinese sales were down 19% over the first 9 months of this year, and it has lost almost $350 million in a Chinese joint venture over the same time period. Earlier this month, it announced that its net income would be reduced by more than $5 billion due to its problems in China. Now, about half of that reflects the cost to restructure, and it's likely to shrink more of their operations in China. The other half is a reflection of the value of the Chinese operations that is no longer justified in today's economic reality. Well, you can look back 15, 20 years ago when General Motors' Chinese operations were a life preserver. It certainly now is not. It's a money pit, according to Jeff Schuster, Global Vice President of Automotive Research and at the research firm Global Data. Every international brand is suffering in China. While GM has yet to announce the details of its restructuring in China, Schuster and other experts are thinking that most Western automakers, including GM, are looking how they can stay longer in this market considering the current conditions. General Motors CEO Mary Barra told investors in October that the Western automakers face a very challenging environment in China, but GM is convinced it can turn things around and remain in the country. Others aren't so sure. There were golden years for GM in China, but those are over, and they're never going to come back, according to Michael Dunn, an automotive consultant who has been involved in Western automaker efforts in China since the 90s, including GM's entry into the market. It's not just GM that's facing problems in China. Most Western automakers rushed to build and sell vehicles in the country at the end of the 90s and the beginning of the 2000s are now struggling. Now, Chinese consumers once preferred Western brands, but now they feel the Chinese brands are a better value. The new preference is driven largely by the Chinese government's policy and incentives to encourage a shift from traditional gasoline-powered vehicles to electric and plug-in hybrid models. Now, if you're a mass seller of other brands, you're highly vulnerable in China, Dunn said. Most of the Western automakers will be forced to exit the market in the next 5 years, if not sooner. Now, the Chinese automakers sell about 70% of their cars in the country, according to data from the Chinese Passenger Car Association. As recently as 5 years ago, they only had 40% of the Chinese market, with foreign brands capturing the rest. When General Motors entered the country, Chinese essentially required Western automakers to partner with a Chinese manufacturer that would have at least a 50% stake in the joint venture. But Dunn said he sees little chance that General Motors will extend its joint venture with them, which is set to expire in 2027, and other smaller Chinese automakers. They also see the other Western automakers pulling the plug from their efforts. Now, Stellantis, which is a European automaker that makes cars under the Jeep, Dodge, Ram, Chrysler brands in North America, saw its joint venture that made Jeeps in China file for bankruptcy in 2022 after years of losses. Now, Ford says it's still profitable in China, but most of its money comes from a Chinese joint venture that exports to other Asian markets as well as South America. General Motors has pulled out of large markets before. The automaker left the European market entirely in 2017, pulling out its Chevrolet brand just after 3 years. Now, the biggest problem in China's is the shift from gasoline-powered engines in recent years to electric and hybrids, which now is the majority of the market. The country had introduced policies and incentives that pushed buyers toward EVs, and they found better values with the Chinese brands. 10 years ago, the Chinese president and the automakers decided, we have been chasing the global automakers in internal combustion engines, and we're not catching up. So we're going to hog the whole entire electric market for China. Western automakers tried to stay the course with its gasoline-powered cars, and for the most, they did okay. But those companies, other than Tesla, which has a factory in Shanghai, are now trailing far behind, keeping up with the lower-priced EVs and hybrids from the Chinese automakers. It was a massive miscalculation by the Western automakers, according to Bill Russo, the head of the Shanghai investment company Automobility and the head of Chrysler's Northeastern Asia operations from 2004 to 2008. Foreign brands did not prioritize this, and they didn't see it coming. Now, much of the shift in the marketplace took place in 2020 and early 2021. The COVID-19 pandemic made it difficult for top executives and Western automakers to travel into China, and it made it easier for them to miss the earthquakes in the market. While Western automakers announced their plans to sell more electric cars, they're still selling gasoline-powered vehicles for at least the next 10 years. They're losing money on EV production even as China gobbles up the market share. They thought they had time, but they didn't have that time. Russo said other huge mistake for Western automakers is to abandon China just because they're not competitive today. Even if the incoming Trump administration pulls back on rules and incentives for U.S. EV buyers, American automakers other than Tesla still have to comply with tough emission standards and restrictions in gasoline-powered cars elsewhere. They'll have to learn how to compete with the Chinese automakers and their affordable EVs in the future. Losing China would be catastrophic for any automotive enterprise, Russo said, but never underestimate a corporation's ability to prioritize short-term profitability over long-term viability. Well, let's shift from the Chinese market to the domestic classic car market and from the pages of Hemmings, ups and down in the collectible market. Well, about a dozen years ago, I was at one of those big auctions out west, and I ran across a former editor who had written about in the past about freelancers. Always great to see him, and a chance that we had to kind of catch up. And I wasn't there to cover the event. In one hand held a cocktail, and in the other was a bitters paddle. Having cashed in on life savings, I was there with a single mission to buy a specific car as, quote-unquote, an investment. And I was kind of taken back about the kind of money that he was talking about and seemingly a rash decision to empty his bank account. I listened to him very carefully. These things never go down. Quote, that line really stuck with me because that's simply not true. Now, just a few days ago, as I wrote this column then, a baseball sold for $4.4 million. Now, to be fair, it wasn't just another collection of cork and yarn and leather stitched together with red thread and some special mud rubbed on it. Rather than it was Soshone Otani who had hit an inaugural member of the 50-50 club. A mighty impressive 50 home runs and 50 stolen bases, and this was the 50th baseball he knocked out of the park. Unprecedented is a proper way to describe it. But what does a baseball have to do with collector cars? Because that number is astonishing, but is that really how much it's worth? The price was certainly fueled by the fact that Ohtani played in his first World Series for the Dodgers about the time that they were going to go to auction. Now, the ball that Mark McGwire smacked in 1998 for a home run number 70 famously sold for $3 million within a few months. Now, since Mark McGwire has admitted using steroids and other performance-enhancing drugs, and this month, the baseball is now estimated to be worth about $300,000, not $3 million. That's a 90% hit, and that is a lot of money. Now, let's be straight. Collector cars are not to be confused with sports car memorabilia, and although the reality is sporting memorabilia, but the reality is there are certain things, and we talk about the marketplace and resto rods, and those are probably the idea of cars on steroids. But more talking about the market, well, it can also be buoyed by and natural forces, and it's time to step back and talk about the ones that will last. There have been multiple corrections in the collector car market over the past few decades. These fundamental shifts in the market have all largely been due to outside forces, but also have been influenced by the changing taste of the hobby. Let's take the 1980s, when the run-up in Ferrari values, which carried the whole collector car market with it. In the late 80s, when Ferraris were in vogue and the death of Enzo Ferrari, investors were bailing on stocks for hard assets and capital poured in from Japan in an already hot market. Speculators jumped in and Ferrari prices went absolutely nuts. Overall, you know, and overnight, cars that traded for $100,000 were now worth $1 million. And when you talk about 2 years later, owning a Ferrari was a venerable gold mine. Then the floor fell out completely from the market just as quickly as it came, and a lot of people got burnt. The worldwide recession had something to do with that. The same time the recession sucked the wind out of the regular car market, it shuttered the doors and plans of many supercar makers and nearly knocked Porsche out for good. The collectible Ferrari market certainly recovered, but it took more than a decade and a half for that to come back. There have been dips since. Currently, its multi-million dollar sports car program from the 50s and 60s are flat at best, and even some are retreating in value. The only thing we can say with any certainty is things go up and things go down, just like the sun. And it is just reliable. You can't be banking on cars to go up completely. That would be a fool's errand. Says for my friend and the editor, armed with his paddle and his life savings and a cocktail, well, he ended up getting outbid on that rare car. And his next egg, well, it's preserved for another day. The most recent example of a rare car that crossed the blocks the past year, hammered out and sold for right around half the price it sold this time. So buyer beware. Well, also from the pages of Hemming, the 1931 Studebaker President 8 Speedway, an impressive roadster inspired by South Bend's success at the Indy 500. Well, Studebaker was entitled to brag a little bit in 1931. Three race cars powered by Studebaker's straight 8 engine had been entered in that year's Indianapolis 500. One, which took the pole position and started from first and went to finish fifth, behind the three Millers and in Duesenberg. Buoyed by this success, the South Bend Company would field a full-fledged factory racing team for 1932 and 1933, achieving a third-place finish in the 1932 contest. In the autumn of 1931, the publicity surrounding the Indy 500 gave Studebaker's leadership a good reason to feel good about its decision to greenlight the company's first straight 8 engine for a passenger car 3 years earlier. Supplementing the company's stalwart straight 6 flathead engine, the new 8-cylinder engine was actually outmuscling Cadillac's larger V8, and by 1932, it had enlarged its engine to a 330 cubic inch and making a surprising 115 horsepower. To celebrate the 1931 result, Studebaker let its hair down with a special version of the President 8 called the Speedway. Introduced in August of that year, it was based on the President 8 four-season convertible roadster. The Speedway was unusually flashy for Studebaker. Distinctive bright red interior, chassis undercarriage in red, radiator slats, wire wheels. Buyers had a choice of two colors, chest light gray or black. The Speedway models were fortified with a higher compression engine, a Stromberg carburetor with bigger throats and jets. The factory produced 100 Speedway roadsters for that model and for the AAA sanctioned speed testing, which resulted in 9 new speed records in Southern California. In response to the widespread demand for an extremely fast car, the press release said, Studebaker announces the new Speedway Model 8 President Roadster, which promises to be one of the most brilliant high-performing stock cars on the road today. Now, all President 8s were distinctive cars. They had undergone a modest restyle for 31 with the new larger radiator cap, fender-mounted parking lights, distinctive oval-shaped headlights, and the four-season roadster featured roll-up windows to keep the cabin snug in the worst weather. The pre-war Studebakers weren't offered with those premium marquees like Packard and Cadillac, but all the 8-cylinder Presidents from 1929 to 1933, apart from the 33 8-2 series, were accepted by the full classics by the Classic Car Club of America. Now, the Roadster in this article was not one of the 100 speedways that were built, but it was restored to full speedway specifications following modifications that any Studebaker dealer could have carried out in 1931. It was built by enthusiast Darren Armacote Jr., who had always wanted to own what he considered the holy grail of Studebakers. Now, in a 2012 interview, Don explained to Terry Shea, now Hemmings Marketplace editor, he found the Roadster listed in Hemmings Motor News in 1994, complete but in primer, needed an engine rebuild, and the car was completely intact, had about 99% of its original wood in it, which was very unusual, Don said. If you want one of these racy Studebakers in your garage, well, you're going to have to do as Don did and probably create one for your own. Classics.com reported that just one 1931 Studebaker Presidential Roadster appeared at auction in the past 5 years, and it failed to sell at an undisclosed high bid. Two President 8 Roadsters were reported sold at that time, a 29 that brought $54,000 at a Gooding auction at an estate in April of 23, and then another 29 that sold for $77,000 at Meekum's May 2021 sale, and appropriately, that sale was in Indianapolis. So a very cool, special Studebaker car in reference to their effort at the Indy 500. Let's talk a little NASCAR news, and the headline reads, the court grants a preliminary injunction request for 2311 Racing as well as Front Row Racing. Well, 2311 and Front Row Motorsports have been granted a preliminary injunction for the 2025 racing season, as well as the approval to purchase charters from Stuart Haas Racing. The preliminary injunction will be for the 2025 season, which will allow the two teams to compete as charter teams in all terms applicable to the charter agreement. The exception is the release of the clause in the charter agreement that will not be enforced. The 2311 Racing and Front Row Motorsports are still pursuing their antitrust case against NASCAR. U.S. District Court Judge Kenneth D. Bell issued the ruling and said that, and citing his ruling, Bell also said NASCAR is prohibited from blocking 2311 Racing and Front Row Motorsports from purchasing a charter from Stuart Haas Racing, and both teams expanding to a third car for the 2025 season. Now, NASCAR, however, has to approve all sales. However, because of the ruling, NASCAR is not allowed to deny the sale of these charters. 2311 Racing and Front Row Motorsports said its initial request and preliminary injunction denied in November by District Judge Frank D. Whitley. Initially, the teams filed an appeal. However, the appeal was dropped in a request for a preliminary injunction that was refiled in November. The new judge, Bell, assigned to the case, made his ruling without holding a hearing. 2311 Racing and Front Row Motorsports were given the opportunity to file a renewing motion for a preliminary injunction if the circumstances changed. In its filing, 2311 said that Tyler Reddick informed the team that it had breached his driver and personal services agreement because they were required to have a chartered car for him to compete in. They had 30 days to cure the breach. If not, December 18th, Reddick would no longer be contractually bound to the team. Additionally, 2311 Motorsports said Riley Herbst had a similar contract, and Front Row Motorsports asserted the same thing for Noah Gregson. Other drivers expressed a similar urgent concern ruling. Bubba Wallace informed 2311 he needs to know how it intends to compete immediately so he can explore other opportunities. And Corey Heim also wrote he needs answers right away so he can speak to other cup teams if other opportunities would exist. The same issue is alleged for sponsors Monster and Love's Travel Stop, both expressed concerns about fulfilling their obligations for the 2025 season. So the good news is the lawsuits are now favoring the teams, and we'll see what NASCAR has to say about this in court. On some more NASCAR news, the headline reads, NASCAR Hall of Famer Fred Lorenzen dies at the age of 89. Fred Lorenzen, whose nickname in the early days was Golden Boy for his exploits in the early days of NASCAR, died earlier this month. He was 89. Fred Lorenzen, one of NASCAR's first true superstars, said NASCAR chairman and CEO Jim France, a fan favorite. He helped NASCAR expand from its original roots. Fred was a picture-perfect NASCAR star to help bring that sport to the silver screen, which further grew NASCAR's popularity during its earlier days. NASCAR's Golden Boy was also the gold standard. also led to the pinnacle of the sport and his rightful place in the NASCAR Hall of Fame. On behalf of the France family and all of us at NASCAR, we want to wish our condolences to the friends and family of Fred Lorenzen. As a member of the NASCAR Hall of Fame class of 2015, Lorenzen has been battling dementia in the later part of his life. He was also named one of NASCAR's 50 greatest drivers in 1989. Lorenzen drove to fame in a short but brilliant career. The Illinois native made NASCAR Cup Series debut in 1956 and won his first race in 1961 at Martinsville. Although he never ran a full season at NASCAR's highest level between his first start of 1956 and his last start in 1972, Lorenzen was a consistent winner when he did enter events. Lorenzen won 26 races and 158 starts, including the Daytona 500 in 1965, two Coca-Cola 600s at Charlotte Motor Speedway in 63 and 65. Lorenzen made starts for some of the most recognizable team owners in the sport. Most of those came in the Hull & Moody, which he won 25 of his 26 race. He also made a start for Junior Johnson. Off the track, Lorenzen was named the sport's most popular driver twice, once in 1963 and again in 1965, and was also inducted into the National Motorsports Press Association Hall of Fame in 78 and the International Motorsports Hall of Fame in 1991. Well, some weird and unusual automotive news from The Drive, and the headline reads, Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad abandoned car collection found with a Ferrari F50 and SL65 Black Series. Well, Assad's extensive car collection was first seen by some of the Syrian fighters as they broke into there. As the Syrian government has collapsed after rebel fighters captured the city of Damascus, the country's longtime dictator, Bashar al-Assad, managed to flee after 24 years of being in charge. Potentially, he has been granted asylum in Russia. Among the many things he left behind was his extensive car collection, which was discovered and filmed by fighters who broke into the abandoned presidential palace. Videos posted to social media and extensively uploaded show a group of men exploring a large warehouse containing dozens of vehicles, from classic supercars to an extremely rare six-wheel camper. Highlights included a Lamborghini Diablo, a Mercedes-Benz SL AMG, SL65 Black Series, a Ferrari F50, an Audi R8, loads of Toyota Land Cruisers, FJ Cruisers, and a brand new Land Rover Defender. There in the Middle East dictators, there's also the Lamborghini LM002 SUV and the Mercedes-Benz 600 Grosser Limo. Finally, the weirdest was the Revcon Trailblazer, an obscure six-wheel RV from the 90s built on a Ford F-350 chassis. Honestly, it's pretty a mild collection for a dictator, no one-off acres of Rolls-Royces. On the other hand, they all look to be in driving condition. In retrospect, the video is kind of fun to watch for automotive enthusiasts, but it also serves as a glaring reminder how Assad lived in luxury while his regime presided over a 13-year horrible civil war in their country. So yeah, I watched the video, and there's some really, really nice cars, but I'm sure all those cars have completely been taken out and probably are about to be sold. Price with our friends over at AAA right now. The average gas price in the United States is $3.02 a gallon, folks. We are so close to a national gas price under $3 a gallon. Right now in Arizona, our average gas price is $3.05, so we're pretty much right on the national average. Our friends over in New Mexico, well, a little cheaper, $2.78. Colorado, $2.89. Utah, $3.02. Nevada, $3.61. And California, $4.34. Texas, $2.62. Oklahoma, average gas price, $2.57. All right, let's see what's our gas prices here in Metro Phoenix. Cheap gas prices in the area. How about Casa Grande, the 76 station, at $2.27 a gallon, folks. That's right, $2.27. The Pride Travel Center in Eloy at $2.29. The Quick Trip in Goodyear on Astoria Parkway at $2.29 as well. All right, let's see what's going on with some Metro Phoenix gas prices actually here in the Metro. Well, the 7-Eleven on Astoria Parkway is at $2.58. The 7-Eleven on 53rd Avenue and Bell Road at $2.59. Costco Station at 33rd Avenue and Grand at $2.65. and the Walmart in Scottsdale on Northside at $2.67 a gallon. Well, it's time for a little car talk. Dear Car Talk, I have a 69 Buick with a 430 cubic inch engine. It'll start fine, then when I go to turn the car off, it just keeps running, even though the key is in the off position. The only way to stop the engine is to disconnect the battery's positive cable and turn the key into the crank position. The only thing to add is when I go to put the positive cable back on, once the car is stopped, it sparks like something is on, even though nothing is on. Any help would be appreciated, and that's from Bob. Well, how about if I help you write a classified ad for this thing, Bob? Actually, I think your problem is the ignition switch. And the ignition switch on this car is on the side of the steering column. The ignition switch has three or four positions, and there's a spring-loaded start or crank position, which temporarily fires up the starter motor until your engine is running. And then there's a run position where the key springs back to once you release it. In the run position, it power goes to the coil, which powers the spark plugs. Now, there's often an auxiliary position which allows you to run a few low-power accessories. In my wife's situation, she uses that to listen to the radio while she waits for me outside the butt lift clinic. There's also an off position, which obviously no power is going to it, except in your Buick, Bob. So I think the switch is just worn out after a mere 55 years of service. It's allowing the electricity to power the coil even in the off position. And once running, the engine keeps running unless something interrupts that process, like a lack of fuel or a lack of spark. That's why when you see the spark when you reattach the battery terminal, it seems like something is on. Effectively, the switch is still in the run position. So I would ask your mechanic if he can test the ignition switch for you. My memory of Buick 69s are fading, thankfully, but I think you should be able to unplug the switch without taking the whole steering column apart. That would allow your mechanic to plug a new switch in and try it out to see if that solves your problem. If it does, then he can remove the steering wheel and pull apart the entire steering column and permanently install a new switch, and then your car will not run on like most other 69 Buicks. Yeah, that's a common problem with a lot of older cars. Sometimes it's not just the switch. It could be something with the timing of the engine, also the carburetor issues as well. But I think the diagnostic on this one, just like it is, seems to be every week in Car Talk, it sounds like a spot-on solution for Mr. 1969 Buick. Well, folks, that's all the time we have for the car show today. My name's Jeff Wine. We'll meet you back again on the radio next Sunday, and you're listening to Sun Sounds Radio of Arizona.